I'm very grateful to be here this evening. My special gratitude to Anil, Kiran, Agnivesh, Priya, for opening the doors of their home for us to gather. When we first came in this evening, Anil Prabhu, to three different people, was very enthusiastically speaking the story of King Ashok. So since you already started the class, I will give some commentary to what you spoke, with your permission. Anil was explaining how Ashok was a very powerful king, who was very aggressive in his conquering. But then he came in contact with the teachings of the Lord Buddha, who the Vedic scriptures have prophesied 2,500 years before his appearance as an incarnation of Lord Vishnu. And when that transformation of heart took place, his whole life changed. Because kings are generally very aggressive, oftentimes egoistic. But Buddha was teaching humility and ahimsa, nonviolence. And what Anil was saying was, with the same enthusiasm, the same aggressiveness that he was conquering and ruling kingdoms, he was sharing the gift of Lord Buddha with the people. Yes? And Anil is so enthusiastic, he keeps talking about this subject. But actually, throughout history, this has been one of the ways great spiritual teachings have been spread to the common people. Christianity was really just a handful of Jewish people who followed Jesus, who was a Jew in the line of King David, and gradually was spreading little more. And then St. Paul, he decided, why should only Jews have this gift? We should spread it to the pagans, the people who really have no proper religion. And he took away a lot of the orthodoxy, which was in the context of Jesus and his followers, and spread it. But it was just not that many people. And whoever took to it was risking torture and death. But then there was a king of Constantinople whose name was Constantine. And somehow or other, he was in the middle of a battle. He was losing. And then he had a vision of the cross of Christ, and he surrendered. He surrendered, if you help me in this battle, I'll give the whole kingdom to you, Jesus. And he won. And actually, that's when Christianity became a religion for the masses, became a state religion. He promoted it widely. There's another king that I'd like to talk about. His name is Prataparudra. He was the king of Orissa. This was about 500 years ago. King Prataparudra was very, very powerful. At that time, the Mughals were conquering practically all of India. People were helpless because they had such massive armies and forces. But they could not penetrate Orissa, because King Prataparudra was such a powerful king with very good armies. He was a man of such dignity. Lord Chaitanya, who is the avatar of Lord Krishna for the age of Kali Yuga, the Prem avatar who spread divine love through Nam Kirtan, the congregational chanting of the holy names, he was actually planning to go to live in Vrindavan after he took the renounced order of life. But his mother, Sachi Devi, was weeping along with his other associates, saying, Vrindavan is so far away, so far away. If you go there, so far from Navadvipa in Bengal, we will never see you or hear anything about you. But the same Krishna that's living in Vrindavan is living in the form of Jagannath in Puri. So please live there, because it's close by. So on the appeal of his mother, he made his residence in Puri. He was just there for a couple months, and then he went on a tour to share his message throughout the southern and western provinces of India. Now at that time, King Prataparudra, his capital was in Cuttack. But he came to Puri, and he heard all about this great saint who was just an embodiment of love and devotion, and he was just transforming people's hearts. Even criminals and ruffians and murderers were becoming gentle and humble lovers of God and servants of every living being. So he asked Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was his teacher, his guru. He said, who is this Lord Chaitanya? I want to meet him. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, he's already left. He's gone for a tour of South India, and he will probably be gone for some years. We do not know when he will return. And the king said, why did you let him go? Why? Why didn't you keep him here? And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, because he's the independent supreme personality of Godhead. He's the Lord of all creation who is incarnated in this world. What power do I have to keep him here? And King Prataparudra, he's the supreme personality of Godhead. Who's Krishna, God, who is incarnated on earth? When will he return? When he returns, please arrange an interview for me to meet him. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, on the basis of scripture, on the basis of philosophy, confirmed that Lord Chaitanya was actually who the scriptures prophesied to come in this world as the Yugavatar, to spread the most recommended and beneficial process of spirituality in this age of Kali that we are living. So when Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu returned after a couple years, King Prataparudra did everything and anything to help the Lord to relieve people of suffering and give them the unlimited joy of love of God. Actually, at first the Lord did not want to meet him because this is very much interesting point. The Lord was a sannyasi. He was a swami in the renounced order. He was playing this role for the benefit of people. And he said, I cannot meet such a egoistic, controlling person as a king. So I will not meet him directly. When King Prataparudra heard this, he has massive wealth, beautiful palace, wonderful family. He said, if my being a king is depriving me of the mercy of the Lord, then on this very day, I will give everything away and I will become a beggar living in the streets. With just a simple loincloth and a wooden earring, and I'll go hand to hand, house to house with a wooden bowl to beg alms as a beggar for the rest of my life. Because what is the use of life without the mercy of God? And he was serious. He actually intended to become a beggar. Not just for one or two days or for a holiday. For the rest of his life. The Lord understood his heart.
this is to the degree he understands that spirituality is significant and of value in his life.
So the Lord and the devotees wanted him to remain in his position. And the Lord gave him his complete mercy.
He actually just wanted to... He tested the king, and in doing so, wanted to show the world the value or the priority of spiritual life.
This is a universal principle of every great religion. In the Jewish scripture, the dearest thing to Abraham in his life was his son Isaac.
And when God told him to sacrifice Isaac, there was nothing worse he could have possibly done. But he was willing to do it if that was the will of God. And when he was about to perform the act, God spoke and said, "You passed the test. It's all right. Isaac's very nice. Let him be." And that, yes, that was the covenant between God and the Jewish people.
Similarly, Lord Jesus, he said, if you love anyone more than you love God, then you are not really a devotee of God. He said, you cannot love God and mammon simultaneously. Don't make your treasure where it will be eaten by the treasures of this world, he said, will be eaten by moths, rusted, corroded by rust, and stolen by thieves. Make your treasure in the kingdom of God, because there it will be permanent. There is no rust, moths, or thieves.
So Lord Chaitanya tested Pratapa Rudra Maharaj to show the world how a man of such stature gave such priority to his spiritual life. He remained as king. But how was he king? He was so humble, he was so gentle, but at the same time, with all the power, with all the intelligence, with everything he had, he ruled the kingdom in a spirit of love and devotion to God and compassion to every living being. Practically the whole treasury of the kingdom was at the disposal for people to elevate and enlighten people's consciousness.
He would set up gigantic places with godowns or storage places with food to cook wonderful, wonderful prasad for the devotees and the general population. He arranged all facilities for spiritual teachers to elevate people's consciousness. At the same time, he protected his citizens. He excised the taxes necessary. He maintained the Justice Department. And he maintained his armies to protect them from the onslaughts of massive armies that were always waiting to attack. But he did it all, not with greed, not with ego, not with lust, not with envy, but with love, compassion, humility, and devotion. And this is the teaching of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita does not teach that we should give up our work, but to perform our work motivated by the highest ideals. Arjuna, in the first chapter of Sri Bhagavad Gita, he was thinking in a very pseudo-spiritual way that there's too much confusion in fighting this war, so I'm not going to fight. Krishna, my charioteer, I'm not going to fight. I'm going to become a real saint and just practice meditation, whatever. And the whole Bhagavad Gita was to teach Arjuna, you must perform your duty, but you must transform your consciousness. Duryodhana was fighting on one side,
And he was motivated by envy and greed. And Arjuna was fighting in a spirit of compassion, humility, and love of God. Extreme example. But this is the teaching of Gita. Some people misinterpret. And they say, what Gita speaks is work is worship. But if that's all Gita taught, work is worship, then the Gita would not be 700 verses. It would be 3 words, work is worship. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks eloquently, scientifically, philosophically, logically, how to make your work worship. And that is all important. Yadhyarata kamanon yatra loko mam karma bandhara taratam karma konteya mukta sangha sama. In the 3rd chapter, Krishna tells that whatever work one's done, what one does, should be an offering to the Supreme. Otherwise, whatever work one does is simply a cause of karmic bondage. Yat karosi yarashnasi yajtu hoshitasya yat tapasyasi konte yat tat guru samadarpana. All that you do, all that you offer and give away, all charity you perform, all austerities you perform, should be done as an offering of devotion. This is Gita. Karman yevati kalashti mapaleshu takashtana. Krishna tells, do not be attached to the fruit of your work, and do not be attached to not doing your duty. This is subtle and difficult for many to understand. How to perform your duty and not be attached to the fruits of your work. Vishayavanivartante niraharasya dehena rasavarajamanasopyasya paramdrisvani vartate. By experiencing a higher taste. What is that higher taste that everyone is looking for? The heart, the soul, is longing for happiness. Anandamayobhyashat. The Supreme Absolute Truth is the embodiment of all pleasure. And every living being who are part and parcel of the Supreme Absolute Truth are by nature seeking pleasure. Today, we were at Keshav and Namamrita's house in Karla in the morning. And they have a very nice pond of water in a beautiful, beautiful garden. And their mother, Maithili Devi, she got very nice fish that she put in this pond. Very sweet fish. They're swimming. And we went to... Srinathji was very proud of these fish. She brought us to see the fish. And one of the gardeners there, when he saw us coming, he wanted to give us some entertainment. So he threw some fish food. And as soon as that fish food hit the surface of the water, the fish just immediately came to the surface. And just, within seconds, they devoured all of it. Yes? Why? Obviously, it tasted good. Maybe not to you, but to them it tastes very good. One man's food is another man's poison. So these fish, they don't have big, big brains, but they're seeking pleasure. Yes? And if your house, especially here in India, if you leave some sweet somewhere on the floor, what will happen? There will be a whole civilization of ants that invade your home. Yes, there will be in lines, and they'll be just standing in line like something like Siddhi Vinayak Temple on Tuesday evening. There's just lines of kilometers of people coming to see the deity of the Lord and take some prasad of the Lord. Yeah, these ants are just lining up and going fast and just trying to get a little of that sugar. Every living being is seeking pleasure.
And in human society, the most developed species of life, where there's such discrimination, such power of free will, we see the whole technology and science is oriented toward people trying to find pleasure. And somehow or other, trying to avoid pain. Why do people want to avoid pain? Because it interferes with pleasure.
Yes.
Why? Why is this the consistent nature of every living being that we're pleasure seeking? The scriptures tell us. Savaipung sangvaro dharma yathopak virudhokshijaya haitikiya pratihataya yatma suprasediti. What real pleasure is. We are all part and parcel of the Supreme. Mamaivamsa jivaloke jivabhuta shanatana. Now the absolute truth, God, who is all attractive, therefore he has the name Krishna. Nam namakari bahu nija sarva shaktis. The Lord has many, many names. Just as the sun in the sky has many names, according to the language of the people who are speaking about sun. God has many names. Krishna means all attractive. Lord Brahma prayed, Ishwara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anadira Dira Govinda Sarva Karanakarana. That the Supreme Lord, or Krishna, has a body that is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. He's the cause of all causes. So we are all, like a sun ray is related to the sun, we are qualitatively one with God, but quantitatively always subordinate to the Supreme, as eternal servants. But the soul, the conscious force, the life within us is Sachit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. The soul must have bliss. It's our nature. When we think with this body, we will look for the bliss through the senses and through the mind. But really, what gives bliss to the soul? To me, a driver in an automobile, if he drinks petrol, which is the nourishment for the automobile, the driver will not be satisfied. What is food for the driver? What is food for the soul? Love. The ultimate pleasure is love. The most fundamental need of every living being is pleasure. And the essence of pleasure is to love and be loved. If you don't have that, there's always emptiness and unfulfilled quest within the heart. One great saint once gave an example that if a person owns everything on earth, the proprietor of everything on earth, but you're the only person alive on earth, will you enjoy? You have all the cars, and you have all the buildings, and you have all the money, and you have all the food, and you have everything. But you're the only person. There's no competition. If one little bird came, if one little bird landed on that finger, that would be the most dear thing to you in life. Because at least the bird is alive and can reciprocate with you to some extent. You could love the bird, and the bird may be able to somehow show some affection to you. Yes? You can't love buildings or cars or money because there's no reciprocation. So love means reciprocal. The soul's nature is to love God. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabunoi Sravanari Sudhijiti Koriyayudoi. The pure love of God is dormant within the heart of every living being. It's our nature. It's our essence. But we've forgotten. so much diverted, so much distracted. So Bhagavad Gita does not teach that being spiritual means being lazy. In fact, Krishna tells in Gita, tells the world that two of the greatest enemies for spiritual progress is egotism and lethargy or laziness. You cannot be lazy. You must be dynamic. If you're a business person, or if you're a politician, or if you're a king, or if you're a swami, or if you're a brahmachari, if you're a doctor, or if you're a lawyer, we have all those things right in the room today. If you're a teacher, or a student, or a mother, or a father, we don't give up our duty. We don't become lazy. But we're motivated with more enthusiastic, with more dynamics. Because instead of being motivated by greed, we're motivated by love and compassion. A mother, she'll work 24-hour shifts for her little baby. Yes? No. You know, how many men will work 24-hour shifts for their boss? Some may, but they won't be very happy about it. But a mother is on call 24 hours a day. Not only on call, but usually busy. I've seen babies cry. Ladies come to me, I haven't slept in days, baby's crying, baby. What to speak if you have twins or three babies? She's not getting paid. She's not getting paid a paisa. But their satisfaction. Because she's motivated by love, by affection. So this nonsense theory that if I become spiritual, if I become dedicated to a spiritual path, then I will become unproductive. No, you'll become more productive, but for the right cause, for the right ideal. Love is a more powerful force than greed or egoism. And that is what spirituality is about. That is what Bhagavad Gita teaches. The Lord descends into this world in so many avatars or incarnations. He comes, sends His Son, His Prophet, his dear pure devotees. Why? What does the Lord have to do with this world? Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samstapanarataya sambhavami juke juke. He comes out of compassion to reestablish the truth, to annihilate misconception, and to protect and enlighten people and bring people back to His eternal loving service. And we see saints, they're willing to die for the cause. And how does that translate down to all of us? To live with the cause of the Lord, to purify our hearts, to live with integrity. Because the greatest act of compassion a person can do in this world is be a good example for others to follow. An example of humility, selfless dedication, self-control, devotion, and integrity. Integrity means to be honest, to be truthful, and to make great sacrifices, whoever we are, for the welfare of others. And Krishna teaches everyone can do that. And in doing that, we can actually express our intent to love God. And simply by that intent, the Lord reciprocates. And gradually,
awakens that love within our heart. And then, what is our motivation?
One time I was in a college. It was a college of students training to be chartered accountants here in Bombay. And you know how Bombay students can be very challenging. Yes? So one student, after my talk, he raised his hand and said, "What would happen if everyone became a Swami like you? Who would grow the food? Shamsundar Prabhu, you're going. Can we get prasad for him before he leaves? Just yes, please. Shamsundar Prabhu, he'll be back Sunday. He's now going to Bangkok in Thailand. Please take little prasad before you." So he said, like, "Who will grow the food? Who will defend the courts? Who will, you know, who will protect the citizens?" And I asked him, "What happens if everyone becomes an accountant like you? Who's going to grow the food? Who's going to protect the citizens? Who's going to maintain all the industries and everything?" I said, "There's a need for accountants. There's a need for accountants. There's a need for lawyers. There's a need for doctors. There's a need for housewives and fathers. There's a need for teachers. There's a need for policemen. There's a need for soldiers. There's a need for farmers. There's a need for architects. There's a need for all these various occupations. There's also a need for swamis somewhere." The purpose a Swami is supposed to have is to just teach society how to utilize their talents, their gifts, and their particular position in such a way that they will be liberated rather than entangled. And that they can do great benefit for the world rather than just add to the karma of the world. So he accepted that answer. Said, "You be an accountant, but don't be motivated by greed and egoism and lust and envy and anger and pride. Be motivated by your own inherent nature as an instrument of God's compassion in everything you do in this world." So yes, King Prataparudra, he lived as a king in that spirit. And how to awaken that great treasure of our original spiritual nature. Several points are very important for this purification of the heart. Associating with pure people. Hearing the pure topics that inspire us with faith and determination for the right cause. And in this age of Kali, Enechi Ashari Maya Nashi Burulagi, the most appropriate medicine for the heart, or let us say for the soul, to cure us of the disease of forgetfulness, for the disease and the symptoms of that disease of ignorance, is lust, envy, anger, pride, greed, and illusion. God's name is most powerful medicine. Why? Because the Lord has incarnated within the name. The power, the opulence, and the beauty and the sweetness of the Lord are within the name. Aishwaryasya samagrasya viryasya yashashasya. The Lord is the supreme embodiment of beauty, knowledge, strength, wealth, fame, and renunciation. And all of those divine opulences are ever present within the holy name. So when we chant the holy name, It cleanses our heart and awakens this attraction. When Hanumanji was building the bridge from Rameshwaram, Setu Bandha, to Sri Lanka, he was tearing off the tops of mountains, which were thousands of tons in weight. But Hanumanji was very strong. He would just rip it off and carry it and put it in and make it float on the ocean. And while he was doing, there's a little spider. Now, what is the difference between the arm of a spider, which really, they don't have arms, they have legs. But what is the difference between the limb of a spider and Hanuman? Huh? All the spider could do was just kick one grain of sand at a time to try to assist in this bridge building. And Hanuman was carrying a massive, massive mountain peak. And he told the spider, "Get out of my way." The spider was on his path. And Ram chastised Hanuman. He said, "This spider is doing everything within his power in my mission. And you are doing everything within your power. I see no difference between the two of you. I do not see what you do. I see your purpose, your intent." Therefore, in spiritual life, higher and lower is not how much you can accomplish. Higher and lower is the purity of our motivation, the spirit of our compassion and love. That is what Krishna sees from within our hearts. In this way, the path of bhakti is equally open for everyone and anyone without discrimination. It is our natural spiritual inheritance to love God and experience the unlimited pleasure of that love and express that in everything we do. That is my humble commentary on your nice class, Anil. Is there a few questions any would like to ask? Or should we have prasad? Any question? Yes.
Is there any such thing as a selfless act?
Selfless act?
Yeah. Is there anything such as a true selfless act? Can you do something without actually wanting something in return?
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
You always feel like you do something and say, "Okay, I don't want anything in return," but get the feeling of having done something instead. Is that selfless, truly?
The Bhagavatam declares, we quoted the verse, "The supreme occupation for all humanity is to act in the loving service of the Supreme. Such service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. To the degree our actions are selfish," which means egoistic, "it cannot satisfy the heart. A selfless act is that in which we are truly giving ourselves for the object of our love." We'll give example of gopis. When Krishna had headache, he asked that, "I need the dust of the feet of my devotees to cure my headache." So his devotee went to many sages in Himalayas, to great pundits in various academic institutions, and requested, "Please, Krishna is requesting dust from your feet to put on his head. He has headache." And they said, no. If we put our feet on God's head, we will go to hell." He said, isn't that true? He said, it probably is. So we're not giving our feet to God's head. Then he went to gopis. Immediately, gopis collected all the dust they could get from their feet and put it in little packages and said, bring it to Krishna immediately, immediately. And they were, don't you know what the result this will be? Putting the dust of your feet on God's head? He said, of course, we'll go to hell forever. You don't mind? He said, no, of course not. If our going to hell forever gives Krishna relief for even 1 second, that will be the greatest joy of our life. That is love. Love is selfless. If we have selfish motivations, it is not really love on a spiritual platform. It is karma. What goes in the name of love in this world is mutual. You give me pleasure, I'll give you pleasure. But to the degree that selfless spirit is not there, we find what happens. If we're not giving each other the proper pleasure, then divorce. In America, 70% of marriages are divorces. And India's catching up. Because that spirit of selfless service is being replaced, which is actually tradition. Tradition of any culture based on spirituality is responsibility for selfless service. For those who we're responsible for. Yes? But when we're thinking, I am mine, Janasya Mohoya Mahamamiti, there was a famous book that today's world is the I society. Everyone is thinking about me. But there's a problem. We don't know who we are. It's all right if you're really thinking about I, but who am I? If we're thinking this false ego is I, and the things related to the false ego is I, then it creates discontent ultimately. And so much potential conflict with almost anybody. Brothers fighting, husbands and wives fighting, nations fighting. But I am the eternal soul. Then there's nothing to fight about. Yes? If we're the eternal soul, what's in our heart is love. And where there's love, the greatest pleasure is selfless service. A selfish person eats and is happy. A person who's selfless in the mode of goodness finds more happiness in feeding others. Yes? A father has some love for the child, has some affection for the child. What brings the father more happiness? Doing something for the child or doing something for me? If there's affection, obviously you're going to be more happy doing something for even if you have to suffer to do it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur prayed, my dear Lord, the sufferings and pains that I undergo to serve you are the greatest pleasures of my life. So yes, not only is there such thing as selfless service, it's our eternal nature. And to the degree we cultivate that spirit, to that degree we'll actually find bliss in life. Does that answer your question? But the nature of the mind is, it is impossible, so I try. But
Pranam Maharaji, if I go to a temple or a church or a mosque or a gurdwara, I don't feel anything different. Is it a correct way, or we should feel by going to temple is better, or mosque is some less, or in church is better? What should be the way?
You should make your heart a temple. Like if we make our heart a temple, we will actually experience God.
Yes,
what the difference is really is the association.
Yes.
Temple is just a building.
Yes.
Yes? It's just a building.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening in the building? The place where people are actually in a selfless spirit of compassion and love, truly worshiping the Lord and surrendering their hearts to the Lord. That is the place where we're going to actually have the most enlightening experience.
At the church or mosque or temple, the same, I think.
Not necessarily. The quality is the same. It's the quality that is important. We have to actually be sincere. Otherwise, sentiment, it's not just a question of what we feel. It's the question of how it transforms our life. You could feel the same going into a cinema. It's not just a matter of feeling. I feel the same if I go into a restaurant as if I go into a church or a mosque or a temple. It's a question of how it's transforming your life. How it's illuminating you and bringing you to higher states of consciousness and higher states of living. That is what's all important. So wherever we actually find that association, those teachings, and that inspiration to really purify our lives and live with integrity and live with humility and live in a spirit of service, that's where we're going to find the deepest experience of God. It's not just which building you go into. Does that answer your question? God is one, no doubt. There's only one God. And an enlightened person will, if you love Krishna, you'll see Krishna in the mosque and in the church and in the synagogue and the gurudwara and in the temple. Krishna has appeared in this way for the sake of these people. Yes? But how to actually come to that state of consciousness where it's not just a feeling but it's a reality. For that purpose, really, temples are not just places to go and give a donation and see a deity and say a prayer. Temples have always been established by acharyas as spiritual educational institutions. Today it's so sad. I mean, it's pious to go to a temple and give a donation and walk away. It's pious. That's nice. But you're not going to get enlightened by that. Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, all these great souls, they built those places so that people could come and actually learn the science, the philosophy, and the culture of purifying their lives, living with morality, integrity, and learning how to love God. That's all important. Otherwise, all over the world, religion is oftentimes very, very superficial. Whether it's Christianity or Judaism or Sikhism or Hinduism or Buddhism or Zoroastrianism or... In Kali Yuga we find most people, it's very superficial. They go, they give some donation or they give some prayer or they take some prasad and they go home and just live like anybody else goes. Maybe a little more piety. But the acharyas, they wanted, you see the deity, but you can't see the deity with your eyes. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, don't try to see God. Don't try to see Krishna. Try to serve Krishna in such a way that he is happy to see you. When we go to the temple, we shouldn't just go to see. We should go to be seen. That the way I'm living, my intentions, my humility, my begging for forgiveness, my begging for mercy, my sincerity, well, God will be pleased to see me. Yes? That should be the proper attitude. But there has to be education. There has to be training. We have so many educational institutions. Our Guru Maharaj went to MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in Boston area. And when he was there, so many courses were being held. He says, you have thousands of courses in your syllabus. But there's not a single course in this whole college that's teaching people who they are. Or what the real, what the ultimate aim of life is. And all of these great tools that they're learning at MIT, they're only really as valuable as the ideals and the intentions of a person's utilization of them. Yes? The most dangerous people in the world are not the uneducated peasants. They're people with big educations, but filthy, dirty hearts, filled with envy and pride and hatred. Yes? They're the greatest dangers to the world. Academic knowledge are facilities, they're tools. The more powerful the tool, the more it could either do benefit or harm, depending on whose hand it's in. Yes? So the purpose of religious buildings really is to educate people to be first-class human beings. People who could actually be examples of integrity and spiritual principle. And when we go into that type of temple, or church, or mosque, or gurudwara, if we go to that place where we're actually getting that higher consciousness, then our life becomes very deep and substantial. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes.
Maharaj, being a businessman, you're constantly living a dual life, especially if you're a devotee. And you're constantly in the association of trying to seek the higher truth or live the higher truth. And then when you're out there being a businessman, you're constantly bombarded by not being truthful or having to be put a facade in front of you. And this duality of existence sometimes extends itself into your normal course of existence. What is the armor that one should be constantly armored with to be in this mode of existence as a businessman?
The secret of success is to learn to harmonize every aspect of our life with the sacred ideals that we're striving for. It is not necessary that there's this sense of duality, because duality is a perception. Yes? And unity is a perception. And we should be striving to purify our perception. That is why spiritual practice is very important. Sadhu Sangam, association with saintly persons, regular spiritual practices at home or coming to the temple. It gives us vision. It gives us a philosophical ideal in which we see the world. Just like, for instance, one person is walking and sees a flower. And that person is just so passionate to go to a cinema, just looks at the flower and doesn't even see it. Right? Another person, you know, so what, a flower? You know, I doesn't see anything in a flower. Thinks, you know, I want a iPod to listen to music. He just sees the flower or something. A botanist looks at the flower and starts just thinking in terms of, you know, what its Latin name is, and, you know, where its origin is. Yes. A person who loves a woman sees the flower and thinks, oh, how I will pick this, how nice it will look in the hair of my girlfriend or my wife. Yes. And a nature lover will just see, oh, such a nice flower. Does any two people see the flower with the same perception? Because our consciousness, our motivations of life are like spectacles or glasses, and they all have different colors.
Yes?
If you have green colored glasses, you see the whole world greenish. If you have yellow colored glasses, the whole world is yellowish. If you have rose colored glasses, the whole world is rosish. Yes? The idea is to have clear glasses, to actually see things as they are. For that, we must purify our consciousness. That means at home, we have... Grihastha means the home is an ashram. It's a place to cultivate spiritual virtues and purification. Yes, it's a place to cultivate love of God. So when we hear about the Lord, when we read the Holy Scriptures, when we chant the holy names of the Lord, when we associate with spiritually minded people, this transforms our perception. We see everything in terms of our spiritual reality, even as business people. You may be doing exactly the same thing as some other business person who's motivated by greed, but you see it with different vision because of how you're cultivating your heart. Does that make sense?
Maharaji, it's about... you are being truthful when you are speaking, and you're practicing that aspect of your life. But when you're sitting across people who are maybe not on the same platform as you are, so you're trying to lift that platform because that's what makes the association of a business complete. But that means you're living a dual life because you're not being 100% honest with yourself. Because that's not what you're practicing or wanting to practice.
You have to define, we all have to define in our own life, you know, what our ideals are. If you're cheating and you're lying for selfish motives, then you're going to have to suffer the karmic reactions. Is that what we want? But if we're trying to be honest, and we're trying to do our work because it's our duty to our family and to our society, but we have to do certain things just because it has to be done, with ethics, morality, and integrity, then that's different. So once again, what is your ideal? What is your motivation? If you don't eat, you will be weak. Yes? If you don't eat properly, nourishing foods, you will be weak. It's like Gary is a physical fitness trainer. And people come to his Malibu gym to get trained. Now, what happens if somebody's starving? How much could they actually work? How much could they build their bodies? You know, Gary will tell them, you know, the types of food they have to eat to have the nutrition by which they will get strength to do it properly. Yes? So spiritually, we need food. Otherwise, we may have big bodies, and we may have very, very profoundly and acute intelligence to do business. But spiritually, we're just feeble weaklings. Yes? And that's what most big people are today. They're just feeble weaklings. Maya just with one finger just pushes them, and they're just, and therefore they give in to greed, and they give in to envy, and they give up to into their selfish, passionate motivations, and they give in to their lust. That means they're just spiritual weaklings. They're starving. And a saintly person will pity such an ignorant fool, although the world is bowing at their feet as being great. Yes? So what I'm saying is that we need food to have strength, and that strength will give us the proper perception. And what is the food we need? Offering prayers, chanting God's names, hearing the truth, associating with saintly persons, doing proper puja with the proper state of consciousness. These are all spiritual practices that are like food, especially hearing and chanting and the association of saintly persons. It gives us food. It gives us strength in which we can maintain our spiritual, moral, and ethical integrity under all circumstances, and we're fixed in our goal. And everyone could do that. We just have to stop making excuses that we can't do it. But if you don't eat and you're weak, then eat. But that's what religion is about, actually. The process of purifying our perceptions. The process of purifying our hearts so that we can do our work with the integrity that will bring us spiritually upward rather than down. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
In other words, we have to become very serious. Yes, sir.
Maharaj, thank you so much. Already I feel inspired. As he is my nephew, after getting inspiration from you, I may like to share something.
Please.
In fact, I find that when we find difficulties in our job, all our business, that is an opportunity when I find a stimulus to grow. For example, today a child came to me whose elder brother had died under me. That child had died. The older child had died under me, and still the family brought this second child under my care. And I was very grateful to God that maybe when I worked with that earlier child, that inspiration was there that you do your duty to the best and you communicate that love for the child and to the family. I also remember an incident when I was working in a public hospital, and at 11 o'clock my outpatient department ends, 9 to 11 I work. At 11 o'clock the mother comes with three children. At 11 o'clock I am supposed to end my work. And she comes with three children. And I gave her a big lecture on small families, happy families. Next morning, when I'm reading my Bhagavad Gita, and after that I sit quietly, that woman comes to my mind, and it was very clear that you gave her a big lecture, small families, happy families, not for her sake, but because your cup of tea was delayed. Because after 11, we will go to the staff room and have tea together. Now, how do you do prashchit for that? The thought comes, do this. Next time when I go to the outpatient department, I ask the nurse who was assisting me, "Sister, what is your religion?" She said she was a Christian. I said, sister, let us imagine that if every child who comes, I am a child specialist, every child who comes today is Jesus coming in the lap of Mother Mary. Would you like to give your best? Shall we try that? And her eyes widely opened. She said, of course, sir, we'll do that. And I must say, by the time our work finished, we might have seen the same number of patients, but it was a different day. So I find, whether in business or in our profession, if such difficulties come, if such moments come, perhaps if we again remember the Lord, He helps us grow and gives us way when both parties win. And nobody is a loser, and at least we happen to grow.
Thank you very much. Spiritual perception. Thank you very much. And I wish to thank all of you very much. Would you like to speak something, Maharaj?
I think that you spoke so thoroughly that there's no real need to add anything.
There's a great need, actually. We're very, very happy to have had this chance to be amongst all of you this evening. Especially happy my old friend Gary has come. Do all of you know him? How many people do not know him? Okay, for Agni Vaish we will introduce. Gary, could we give microphone to Gary? He can tell you about who Gary is.
Does anyone have any questions to Gary? He'll answer them for you. Yes. Yes.
We love Maharaj so much, all of us. He's a spiritual inspiration. And he inspires us by so many wonderful qualities. I was very impressed yesterday or the other day when you were telling that story about the vest. And somehow how much Maharaj impacted you in a very loving relationship. I'm wondering, what are the things that you saw in Maharaj then that inspired you so much? And I'm wondering if it's perhaps some of the same things that inspire us now. Perhaps, yeah, I was just curious about that.
Maharaj speaks all the time of the right association with people, you know, and I saw in Swami Radhanath Maharaj, I saw in him at a very early age the qualities of love and kindness, compassion, and a love and a joy for life. You know, he's just always been a great person, fun to be around, and an inspiration. I think the qualities that you see in him are the same ones I've seen in him, you know, for 45 years. I mean, he's just that kind of person, always has been.
Anyway, you said he's a great person. I think a great person is one who reciprocates love and draws you to that. And I think you've had that experience with him.
Absolutely. You know, he's been my best friend almost my whole life. And, you know, I don't... I wouldn't say that about just anybody. I mean, you know, he's like, I love him the same as I love my brother, because there's no difference. You know, he's my family, and I'm sure, I hope he feels somewhat similar about me. I don't know what else you guys want to hear. if anyone has any more questions, I'll answer them to the best of my ability.
You mean
with just anybody, or
anybody.
In my relationship with Swami? I mean, a man like Swami, there's never the hate part. I can honestly say I can never remember a time when I was angry with Swami right now. I can't say it about anybody in my life. No woman I've ever known, not my mother, my father. I mean, I have never been angry with him because he's never done anything to make me feel that way, you know. So, if we're lucky, we meet lots of people that we feel this way about. But in reality, I think that most people have a love-hate relationship. You're right. How do you deal with it? I guess you have to focus on the principles that Swami teaches you, you know, about doing everything in the service of the Lord. That's my guess. He would know more than I do about that. Is there anything else anyone wants to know about me or Swami that I can help enlighten you?
I have been told beautifully that as Maharaj described that you bring the body and Maharaj put things inside.
That's correct.
A very good combination.
I help pull the body and he tells people that we are not the body, so but somehow it works out and we reconcile the differences. No, what Swami says it told me was that the body is a temple which gets the vehicle that gets us through this life, you know, and so you want to take care of your temple and keep it healthy and strong, you know, and then when you go in the temple he takes over from there and teaches you how to live right, you know. So, you know, I guess we can work together on this thing. Swami and I are an example, a good example of people who have taken very different paths in life, and yet the love we've always had for each other hasn't diminished in the least, you know. So if everyone in the world interacted the way we do, I think it would be a great place. There wouldn't be all the wars and the hatreds and everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
Would you like to answer that one?
This is more your field of expertise.
That is a very complicated question. What is Hinduism? In today's world, Hinduism can mean anything. The word Hindu is not found anywhere in any of the authorized scriptures. The word is Sanatan Dharma. Yes? Those who follow the Vedic culture follow the principles of Sanatan Dharma. Dharma means occupation. Dharma also means the intrinsic nature of a thing or of a person. The intrinsic nature of sugar is that it is sweet. The intrinsic nature of a chili is to be hot. Yes? The intrinsic nature of water is liquidity. If you put it in an artificial circumstance, it can turn solid ice. But as soon as it comes to a natural setting, immediately it melts into liquidity. So the intrinsic nature of every living being is to serve. You cannot live without serving. You're either serving your family, or serving your boss, or serving your country, or serving the government, or serving your mind, or serving your senses. Yes? Everyone is serving. So the nature of everyone is to serve. And sanatana means eternal. The eternal nature of every living being is to serve God, because we are part and parcel of God. Some are serving His external energy, or maya, or illusion, and some are serving His internal energy in love and devotion. But that is our constitutional nature, to serve God. So this is actually what Hinduism is, because this is what actually the Vedas teach. And this is the essence of every religion. To actually live in harmony with the laws of God, to cultivate a purification of the heart. And Jesus in the Bible said, you can judge a tree by its fruit. A person may call himself a Hindu or a Jew or a Christian or whatever, but actually, what is the fruit? If the fruit is love and peace and self-control and compassion, then we understand that the tree is good. That we're actually connected properly. So you can explain like this. What is Hinduism? Hinduism means to know that we are the eternal soul. To know that we're part of God. And to cultivate a spirit of love and devotion to God in everything we say, everything we think, and everything we do. And to live in a spirit of compassion to other living beings. That is a Hindu. And essentially, that is a real Christian. And that is a real Muslim. Sanatana Dharma is not sectarian. Is that a good answer? And then you could tell them about King Ashoka also. But Gary is such a wonderful, wonderful person. He's speaking about something about me, which I don't really believe. But also his open-mindedness, because to many conventional Americans, I'm quite a strange creature. But yet, because of our relationship and because of his open heart, he has so much affection and so much respect. And we've always had that toward each other, even through many phases of transformations in our lives. He's always been a person, and if you go to where he lives today, I see with my eyes that same spirit that he had as a child is still very much there, always wanting to do things for others, always wanting to be very fair, always wanting to be very helpful, always wanting to be the best friend of whoever he's with. And he had everybody who he knows practically, they tell me he's their best friend. People really love him because he really loves to help people and show respect to people and make people happy. So he's always been of that nature. And we used to try to be like that together. And now when I come to visit him at Malibu Beach, he just brings all of his close associates and his clients and his friends. He just opens their hearts to sit just like we are today and just hear about spiritual truths in Krishna. And by the time I get there, they're already, like, their ears are open and their hearts are open and they're eager to hear. Just because of the way Gary
expresses his affection toward me and like that. So we have a very extraordinary relationship in that sense. But friendship and love goes beyond sectarian differences. I congratulate both of you. Wonderful, wonderful. Would you like to speak something else? Yes, please. Can we give...
From Gary describing you, and you describing Gary, although you say... although he's saying there's so much difference and the path is... have gone so much different, it seemed that there's a common quality that you both see other people in terms of their desires rather than your own, which is basically the nature of loving. So I wanted to ask you is, how does that quality relate to spirituality?
You know better than me, Maharaj.
I don't know better than you. Because I am narcissistic. I see everything in terms of my own desires and fears. That's why I'm asking this. Because I'm seeing two people who have such wonderful spirits. And I need to be helped.
Please answer.
One of the qualities of Maharaj, and you may have noticed this, is that you could never defeat him in an argument. I don't know if you had the same experience. But
you just defeated me.
And he just defeated me.
We never had an argument, so I didn't.
Well, let me put it this way. Sometimes I try to outlove Maharaj, and that's impossible.
He has enough love for everyone, so there's no reason to try.
Actually, Gary and I have always had differences. Yes, especially when we traveled together. But whenever there was a difference, we were just respectfully, you do your thing, I'll do my thing, and we'll meet this evening. And that way we never had arguments. Yes? Something like that?
Exactly. Are you waiting for an answer to something?
No, I'm just enjoying.
I found that all over the world people have this feeling of serving others and selfless compassion. It's not just the people in this room, but everywhere, that I've been. That's a quality that you find all over. That's... I've experienced that in my stay here in Bombay so far. I mean, the people have been so nice to me. I've got here and I got very ill from a layover in Moscow. I wasn't prepared then, and I'm starting to get better because of Radha Priya. This woman has taken care of me. My own mother couldn't have done a better job. She hovers over me all day, bringing me food and medicine. And
I will confirm because I know his mother.
Yeah. she's embodies selfless giving and compassion. I mean, as strong as I've ever seen in any person anywhere I've ever been. And that's just one example. I'm sure there's everyone here has the same story, So I think it's like Swami Radha says, just if you do something, you should do it for the right reasons, in the service of God. And if you do it in the service of God, you can't go wrong, right? So Every time I've spoken, I've thanked these people here for making me feel so welcome on my trip to Bombay, but I got to keep doing it because I'm so overwhelmed by the acceptance and the love that I've experienced here. It's I wasn't quite expecting that kind of reception, and I want to thank all of you so much. You know, you've made my stay. It wasn't what I didn't want to come here and get sick, but if I had to do it anywhere, I would like to do it here because of the mostly because of Radha Priya. Thank you so much. Thank you. Is there any more questions that I can help answer? Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. Yes. No, I think my personal feeling is that we are all a product of the experiences of our life, you know. And the most formative years of my life was the years I spent traveling around the world. And the best part of that trip was the time I spent with Swami Radhana. You know, I mean, when you travel with him, you don't just travel, but you see it through spiritual eyes, you know. And I absolutely think that who I am today is greatly enhanced by the experiences of my travels. Absolutely, you know. So, yes. Does that answer your question? Any other questions? You have any questions, Swami Radhana?
Yes, please accept me as your servant. So now we can all have prasad. Thank you very, very much. And everyone, please give Gary your nice company and accept his nice company, and that will be very special. And especially grateful for the darshan of His Holiness Dhanadhar Swami Maharaj, who is one of my very, very, very dearest friends in life. We've also gone through many transformations. But he's such a... always seeing the positive. Always seeing the positive. Always seeing the up. Always seeing Krishna's hand in every situation. Very deeply learned in the scriptures. Very deeply realized. And just a person who really, really loves Krishna and loves everyone. Thank you, Dhanadhar Swami Maharaj. It's always blissful to be close to Maharaj. And my special thanks to you, sir. Your good name, I'm sorry?
My name is Raj Kumar Anand.
Dr. Anand, we're very grateful that you came. And thank you for your wonderful... experience that you shared with us. Very special. And thank you to Anil, Kiran, Priya, and Agnivesh Prabhu, and to everyone that has assembled tonight. Please enjoy nice prasad. Thank you. Hare Krishna.